You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ever since his first solo show in New York in 1966, Bryce Martin has been regarded as one of the most influential artists of his generation. In 2006, he traveled to Taipei, where he was inspired by works of Chinese calligraphy, and the drawings and paintings that trip inspired are included in a new exhibition, Bryce Martin Letters, on view at Matthew Marks Gallery through December 23rd. It is Mr. Martin's first one-man show in New York since the Museum of Modern Art mounted a retrospective of his work in 2006. And this new series is the largest body of work he's made since 1991. I'm very pleased that it has brought Bryce Martin back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Can you describe the work of Chinese calligraphy that inspired this series? It was just one work?
No, there was a group of letters by Mei Fu. And I can't remember whether they were separate or together. I mean, the Mei Fu, there was one group that had been collected and it mounted on as a scroll. The Su Tong Po letters, I'm not quite sure. I think they were individual. But I've been reading Su Tong Po's poetry for a while. So,
well, almost every piece of Song Dynasty calligraphy has looked beautiful to me, at least anything that I've seen on exhibit. Is there something specific about these works from 1087 that you found particularly inspiring? Was it the quality of the line or the texture of the paper or the way they were put on the page?
They just seem very immediate. They were still just immediate. And, I mean, I don't read Chinese. I don't.
Did you know what the poem said?
No. It's just for me, it's just purely visual. And but I do read the poems and I have read translations and stuff like that, but I don't directly. I'd rather just look at the piece.
Well, Taipei is a repository of some of the greatest of all Chinese art. That's because when Chiang Kai-shek fled the country after he was defeated by Mao Zedong, he took a lot of the art treasures with him. Is this part of that?
Yeah, this was. And this is in the National Palace Museum, which is the repository for that stuff. And the reason I went there was because they had an exhibition of Ru ware, which is kind of the rarest imperial porcelain. And they were going to have 40 pieces or so. And there's only about 40 known pieces in the world. So it was like a once-in-a-lifetime sort of opportunity.
You know? You're a lover of Ru ware?
Well, it's very beautiful. Mm. It's just exquisitely beautiful. It's one of these kind of things, you know, where there's so many things that look like it, and then this just shines forth as a completely different thing.
But then you came upon this calligraphy.
Yeah.
Did you start making drawings right away?
Yes. We were doing a trip. My wife and I were doing a trip in Southeast Asia, and we went... We were in Indonesia, and I just started doing drawings that I thought I was thinking of them as letters of gratitude. And they were like letters to – basically, I ended up giving them to people that really helped in putting together the show at the Modern. And that sort of started it. And
well, when you say letters, these don't look like Chinese letters or like in the case of Indonesia, I'm not exactly sure what – the alphabet there looks like, but I know it looks more like Indian alphabet.
Yeah, this is just my own sort of shorthand fake calligraphy.
Mm-hmm. Not like Franz Klein did shorthand fake calligraphy.
No, these are more characters, and they would be in lines. I mean, done the Chinese way, you know, top to bottom, right to left.
Mm-hmm.
But then once that basic grid is set up, I draw back into it and make all sorts of connections. So it just becomes a different, it doesn't adhere to the look of a piece of calligraphy.
Letters is your first series since Cold Mountain, which you made in 1991. And wasn't that also inspired by calligraphy?
Yeah. Well, that had dealt more with the poems. But I saw the form of the poems in Chinese in a book by a poet named Red Pine, where he had his translation, but he had the Chinese printed out. So I could just see the form of the poem, and I based those paintings on that form, which was like there were three or four couplets made up each poem.
Well, it's often there's often been links made between poetry and painting, and I've always wondered about that.
Well, when I did the
Cold
Mountain
poems,
because
they're both about metaphor.
Well, when I did the Cold Mountain poems, I was reading the Cold Mountain. I mean, when I did the paintings, I was reading the poems, and I think it had a big effect on the paintings. I mean, that's basically all I read while I was doing the and. I mean, it has that sort of effect. And I, you know, I'm a romantic painter. You know, I consider poetry and painting very, very close, almost the same thing, except one's done with words and the other's visual.
And many of the finest art critics have been poets.
True, yes.
I've read that you have a collection of seashells and Chinese scholar's rocks in your studio. What is a scholar's rock?
They're rocks that were collected because they are interesting objects. And they were collected by the scholars. They would keep them in the studio. It was sort of a metaphor about the landscape or a reference to the landscape or the microcosm of the landscape or the energies, the flow of energies within the landscape. And I just started collecting them because – well, I liked that whole idea, plus they were cheap. And, you know, and they're quite inspirational. I did a lot of stuff really based on the rocks. I would make up my own rocks, my own rock collections, you know, make groups of drawings of rock collections.
My guest is Bryce Martin, who has actually two exhibits right now at Matthew Marks Galleries next door to each other. The other exhibit is earlier paintings, and your style has changed so radically. Was the change because you started becoming interested in Chinese calligraphy?
Yes. I mean, I had seen a calligraphy show at Japan House. It was 1,000 years of Japanese calligraphy. And I got very interested in it, started investigating it, was led to Chinese calligraphy, which I preferred because it was less elegant. And it seemed the drawing was a bit harder. And it just, you know, I just started making paintings somewhat based using some of the ideas of the calligraphy.
Well, your early paintings involve color fields, worked with a lot of texture. And one critic even said he had an urge to nibble on those canvases. There's no texture now. You used to work with wax. There's no wax anymore, is there?
No.
So
no.
You just totally changed everything in mid-career?
Well, at a certain point, I stopped using the wax because it was it's very delicate. I mean, wax never hardens. You can put chemicals into it to make it hard, but that was sort of against. I liked using wax because it was a very natural material, and I didn't like making it synthetic.
And it does feel like it's never going to get hard. That's part of the appeal of those paintings.
Yeah. And
it almost feels like you put buttercream on the canvas.
Yeah, yeah. But when you touch them or rub them, they shine. Mm-hmm. And it's like shoe polish. And you can't get it out. You know, so it was a problem when you're making monochromatic paintings. I was having a lot of technical problems. So I switched to something called terpineol, which is a further distillation of turpentine, which mixed into oil paint produces a matte surface, which is what I was interested in. I didn't want any shine or, you know, interference in the observation of the color. So using a terpineol, which I still use. And when you get up close to these paintings, I mean, it's a pretty funky surface. It's not built up, but it's not a refined.
No, it's a hard edge painting.
Yeah, yeah.
My guest is Bryce Martin, who has two exhibits at the Matthew Marks Galleries, but the one we're discussing is Bryce Martin Letters, a lot of new work, in fact, largest group of new works since 1991, if as I understand it correctly. Well, anyway, we can always correct that when we come back. Yeah. We will be back after a little break. Stay with us. Later on in this hour, find out why, despite its array of spiced meats and wonderful pastries, Egyptian cuisine has remained something of a culinary secret. I hope you're hard at work, by the way, finishing your entry to our Cheap Craft Contest, which will be judged by Amy Sedaris. We're asking you to create a holiday craft for a loved one with found objects and materials that cost $10 or less, and then to take a picture of your creation and enter it in our contest. But hurry, the deadline is today at 5 p.m. For more details on how to enter your craft, visit our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from the New York Philharmonic, performing Beethoven's Second Symphony and Mahler's Das Knaben Wunderhorn, with soloist Ian Bostridge. Sir Colin Davis conducts. This Thursday through Tuesday, tickets at nyphil.org. Freelancers Insurance Company, a non-traditional insurance company offering health coverage to members of Freelancers Union. Coverage is available to members in a wide range of professions. More information available at freelancersinsurancecompany.com. Penguin, publisher of The Track of Sand by Andrea Camilleri. Inspector Salvatore Montalbano negotiates the mafia-connected underworld of horse racing in order to solve crimes close to home. The Track of Sand, available wherever books are sold.
It's that time of year just about everybody's thinking about balancing the job with family life. Author and academic Joan Williams says it would help if employers woke up.
They are still designing the 21st century workplace for a workforce of about 1960.
We'll talk about her provocative and political take on work-life balance next time on Tell Me More. Weekdays at 2 p.m. on AM 820 WNYC.
WNYC is supported by the Vineyard Theater, hosting discussions of its recent production, The Scottsboro Boys. This Vineyard Voices event includes the author, cast members, and critics, and is followed by a Q&A. More information, vineyardtheater.org. WNYC is giving away three pairs of tickets for Friday, December 3rd at 8, starting with the fourth call to reach us at 646-829-3985. But as always, if you've won anything from WNYC in the past 30 days, you're not eligible for these tickets. We're back with Bryce Martin, who is having his first major exhibit since his retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in 2006. This is at the Matthew Marks Gallery, and it runs through December 23rd, and we have a slideshow of some of the works on our show page at WNYC.org if you want to get a sense of what we are discussing. So you've come to this crisis in your career. You're working in wax, and this is it continues to produce, to create technical problems for you. Jasper Johns was using encaustic. Would that have been a good way to go?
Well, Jasper was a big influence, but I was using oil and wax. Mm-hmm. You know, encaustic is, you know, it's pigment and wax, and you have to reheat the pigment after you apply it. And,
does that have more permanence?
Well, it's one of the, I mean, the Egyptian tomb paintings are encaustic. I mean, it lasts if you take good care of it, like lock it up in a tomb. And I had studied with people in Boston who had studied with Carl Zerbe, who was a big encaustic painter, and I studied with guys like David Aronson and stuff like that.
You had gone to Yale, which
I went to Boston University first, and then I did Yale graduate school.
Which was the hot graduate school, along with Hunter College at that time in the 60s. Was it the quality of the teachers that made it such an important school?
I think it was there was also the fact that Albers had been there and he had just left. Mm-hmm. And so the school was sort of very open and no one was trying to step into his shoes. So it was quite free. And I mean, one of the great things with the other students, I mean,
some very famous artists came out of that class.
Yeah, a lot of good people came out. Yeah.
Such as?
Well, Richard Serra, Chuck Close, Bob Mangold, Sylvia Mangold.
Not bad.
Janet Fish, you know, Nancy Graves, Maxwell Downs. I mean, and just the diversity of what they do is a good sign of what the school was up to or not up to.
And what were you doing at that time?
I was painting abstract expressionist paintings.
The style of the moment.
I remember Jack Torkoff coming into the studio, and I was working on this big sort of summation opus thing, and he said, this is a cliche on de Kooning, this is a cliche on Klein, this is a cliche on... And he was absolutely right, and that's when I just sort of refocusing. Trying to get rid of the cliches.
Well, that's part of what school is supposed to help you do, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, you know, these really great teachers came in, and you had two visiting critics up from the city, you know, beginning of the week, end of the week, a romantic, a classicist, and they knew a lot more about it than you did, so it was very helpful.
Now, these new paintings have borders, margins on them, not borders, margins. Is that a reference to Chinese calligraphy as well?
Yeah, it's based on, you know, how these things get mounted. And what the Chinese do is they put everything behind the image. So what's always the closest thing to the viewer is the ink. You know, whereas here we put, I had a group of prints of reproductions by Su Tong Po, and I sent it to the framer. I said, do whatever you want to it. They came back. They had a really thick mat and a big frame, and it just wasn't right. And, you know, I looked the prints, I looked the things up. And basically, you don't, you put everything behind it. You don't put anything in front of it because, you know, above the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the ideas of it. And plus, it was just a sort of setup. It gave me another. I had these horizontal chassis, and by using the border, it turned the image into a more square shape. So there was that kind of dichotomy there. And then it also gave you another color element.
Do you ever get tired of painting? Because when you came along in the mid-60s, there were artists like Robert Morris who were declaring that painting was dead.
Yeah.
And that was a major crisis. I was an art student at the time. That was a major crisis for painters like me. Because I had grown up in a slightly earlier idea. I had studied with Ed Reinhardt, who used to say that sculpture is the stuff you bump into when you're backing up to look at the painting. So I still believe that painting was the primary thing in art.
Yeah, that's what – I mean, I basically I came out of an academic background at BU, but I was really interested in abstract expressionism. And we were following abstract expressionism very closely. And you know, it was – these guys were having shows every 2 years, you know, and it was easy to follow. And then, you know, with guys like Judd, Morris, you know, they were saying painting's dead.
Of course, Robert Morris later went back to paintings.
Yeah, right. I took a very defensive attitude about that and say, no, it isn't dead. And I think we just keep on going. And that's just what I've tried to do.
And you have worked in a very classical format, oil paint on rectangular canvases.
Yeah, I now feel very conservative.
Because another thing that painters were doing at the time was shaped canvases to get past what they felt was the dead format.
Yeah, and the shaped monochromatic, you know, no hand, you know, a lot of spray painting. You know, there was, you know, sort of a revolt against expression.
Well, have you gone in the other direction? Because you were doing monochromatic paintings, and although they had texture, they were closer to hard edge paintings than they were to the earlier abstract expressionist paintings you're doing. Now you work in some ways feels like it has a certain kinship to Jackson Pollock, to some of the later de Kooning paintings. We're back to the abstract expressionists.
Well, not really. I think there's a different kind of spatial awareness. You know, they're the space is tighter. I mean, I consider, you know, the advance of modernism is about flattening the space. Mm-hmm. And we've got it really up there on the surface. I think my more recent stuff, it expands a little bit. But you take someone like, you know, sort of the ultimate master is Ryman, and he's got it right up there on the surface, and there's just so much information he provides you with. I mean, they're just incredible.
Robert Ryman.
Yeah.
A painter who only paints in one color and yet finds so much in one color, white. You made that trip to Taipei while the retrospective of your work was on at MoMA. Is there a feeling when a retrospective like that is mounted that you've kind of come to the end of something and that you have to find something else?
Well, yeah. I mean, you think that's what – I thought that's what was expected. And I was, you know, very concerned about, well, you should make some change. And then I thought, well, I'm not going to make some change just because everyone thinks I should make some change. And but then I started on this group of paintings, and I thought for a while I would never be able to finish a painting again. I thought there was like a kind of curse, you know, the curse of the retrospective, you know, and I wouldn't be able to finish it. And then these things kept going and going and going. And the way I was working one was like I would work the painting, and then I would go over the whole thing with the wash of the ground color and then work back into it. And I kept doing this and doing it and doing it.
One painting at a time?
Or? Yeah. Well, I usually work a group. Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, the painting, the show divides into two parts, the smaller paintings and larger paintings. And the bigger ones I did upstate. I have a studio in Tivoli, New York, and the other ones in my studio in New York. And eventually one got finished.
Because it's my sense that there are two kinds of artists. Maybe there are more, but they're the ones who work on one painting at a time, and that's it. And then there are the others who seem to be engaged in some kind of a dialogue between all of the work they're doing at a certain time.
Yeah, I would come closer to the second group. Mm-hmm. I mean, I usually work groups right now.
And one then talks to the other? You do something on one, and then that sort of opens up the other painting?
You work on something, and something comes up, and you apply it, and others. And, I've always worked that way, you know, and it's just convenient for me.
There's a slideshow of images from the exhibit we've been talking about on our show page. The exhibit, Bryce Martin Letters, is on view through December 23rd, just 2 days before Christmas at the Matthew Marks Gallery at 522 West 22nd Street. And then there's a satellite show of earlier work by Bryce Martin. You want to see both of them. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.